This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
This episode of the Baby Tribe Podcast is proudly sponsored by HappyTummy.ie, the exclusive distributor of BioGaia probiotics for babies.
That's right. And as parents ourselves, we know how crucial it is to prioritize our children's health. BioGaia probiotics have been clinically proven to support digestive health and reduce the duration of crying in babies experiencing colic.
Absolutely, and HappyTummy.ie makes it incredibly convenient for parents to access these products.
Amazing! So for all your probiotic needs, head on over to HappyTummy.ie.
And Baby Tribe listeners can enjoy a 10% discount on all products at HappyTummy.ie with the code BABYTRIBE10. Okay, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Baby Tribe Podcast, your essential companion through the journey of parenting. I'm Professor Afif Al-Kafash, a neonatologist, paediatrician, researcher and lactation consultant at the Rotunda Hospital Dublin and the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland.
And I'm Katie Mugan, a paediatric and public health nurse and a lactation consultant. Together, with over 40 years of experience in caring for infants and children, we're here to share expert insights, inspiring stories, and give you access to an amazing array of experts in parenting and the field of paediatrics.
Before we dive into today's topic, remember to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform. Your ratings and reviews help us reach more parents like you, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Now, let's get started with today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 3 of the Baby Tribe Podcast. It's been way too long, Katie, hasn't it?
This is our first meetup since when, November?
Yes, absolutely. And I do have a bone to pick with you, actually.
Ooh.
I think we should rename the podcast to My Co-Host Ghosted Me, because I haven't heard from you. I haven't seen you. You don't text. I send you long VMs and you just don't respond. And you just turn up today to record. And, you know, I have my wife. To ignore me like this, I don't need you to be doing the same thing. So what's your excuse?
Well, now, in fairness, Afif, I'd like to say it was down to me having a wild time, but it's called parenting with four kids and they've got more activities than anything else. Plus, do you know what? Just before Christmas, we ended up with the worst sickness in our house. We haven't been sick in I don't know how many years because we're kind of through that stage of the small kids and then crash and everything else. But we all got a really bad flu. So that's pretty much why I ghosted you. I spent most of my time in December lying on a couch or parenting sick kids.
I'd love to be able to believe you, but I don't, because I see you going on your Instagram page, chatting to all your followers, giving them updates about what you're doing. And then you just don't
respond. I'm going to have to block you.
Yeah.
You'll know I've really ghosted you when I actually blocked or restricted you.
It's actually really hard to know that you're being blocked on Instagram. It's not the same as Twitter where it says you have been blocked. On Instagram, you just stop seeing people's posts and then you just can't find them. Yeah.
Interesting. I've never looked into it, but now I'm probably going to start looking and saying, has anyone blocked me?
And you're going to ask me, how do I know that all of this is because I think I've been blocked by a couple of people.
This is purely Afif's insecurities now, all coming out. Yeah. Lay it out on the table, Afif.
Yeah. Speaking of insecurities, January was the first time as a dad I've had a teenage boy child. And my God, I don't know what your experience is, but they change from being this lovely child that looks up to their dad and I'm a superhero to him no matter what I do, to the cynical little shit that, oh my God. So the other day I was and this is going to be a very embarrassing admission, I was bopping to one of Ariana Grande's new songs in the kitchen, and in he walks and he just stands and looks at me and he goes, Dad, the only song she'd play if she saw you is Thank You Next.
Oh my God, I can't believe that. Well, in fairness, I would probably say the same if I walked in and saw you bopping to that. Now, even though I love Ariana Grande, but do you know what I have? Well, see, you're a little bit ahead of me in that you've already had been exposed to a teenager. Luke turned 13 in October. God, I better not say, I nearly forgot. But in October, and he's our first. So I laugh, and I sent him actually an Instagram reel from someone else about, you know, the first child versus the fourth child and how the first. And he actually totally agreed with me this morning where, you know, they're really sick. And I'm like, unless you're dead or dying, you're going to school. That's with the first. And on the fourth, basically it showed that the kid coughs and the mother's running up to the room going, oh my God, are you okay? And he goes, that is it. That is so true. And I'm like, okay, whatever, Luke, you're fine. But no, he has gotten a little bit moodier. But you know what? I still get the cuddles from him. Like, he's really still like, he'll sit on the couch and cuddle into me. Whereas with Jim, it's all business. It's like a totally different relationship. It's funny when you look at both couples.
He's still quite cuddly with his mom. Yeah. And with me now, he's a lot less. So we used to kind of watch a movie together, and he'd snuggle up and ask me to put my arm around him, and that's all gone now.
Well, actually, Jim would say it's nearly like a debate. Every time they sit down for conversation, it's debates going on between the two. And like Jim even goes, I think he thinks we're best friends. Like, it's a completely different relationship between myself and Luke. And then I look at Jim and Luke, and they're quite similar in personalities and yet so different.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, funny. That's what happens. I haven't got there. I just dread to think when I've got four of them in the house and the hormones are going wild. I don't know. I'll probably move out.
I don't know how you do this. We have two and we're barely managing. Yeah.
That's why I don't get to talk to you, Fief. And, you know, when you ring, you know, they go to voicemail.
I know. Yeah, you never call back. Or you call back and I sometimes ignore it.
You actually sound like my mother now. I rang you three times today and you didn't respond.
Okay, so I feel better that I'm not the only one that gets ignored.
Oh, no. My mother and my parents are always like, you never answer that phone. I was like, I do.
So we have an exciting season.
I am so excited about season three.
We are expanding into the realm of early childhood and childhood in general. We've got a lot of feedback from listeners saying that they want to hear from more experts. And I wanted to reassure listeners that we have heard those requests. And we have an amazing lineup of experts, some of whom are actually international, world-renowned experts in their field that are going to tell us all things we need to know about pediatrics, parenting, early childhood. So we're broadening our horizons, aren't we?
I am actually so excited for this. I think we're all going to learn a bit from these experts on parenting. And a lot of them, I suppose, they're probably colleagues of you, some of them, Fief.
Yeah, and that's the advantage that we have, because you know what? Pediatricians in general are quite media shy. They don't like going on media to chat about things. And I was able to kind of, you know,
coerce them.
Yeah, I was going to use the word entice them, but coerce them into coming onto the Baby Tribe podcast to share their knowledge. And we are very cognizant of keeping all the episodes quite broad and general, that it would be applicable to everybody that has a child from the age of 0 up to the age of 18. And in fact, our guest at this episode is going to give us insights into parenting throughout the ages. And I'm really, really excited about that. So we'll chat about that in a little while. We are pausing for a moment to announce that the Baby Tribe is now part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, Katie. It is nice to feel wanted and sought after. We are delighted to be joining the network that actually won the Best Network Award at the recent Irish Podcast Awards.
That's right, Afif, and they are celebrating their 10-year anniversary this year, so it's lovely to join them at such a momentous juncture. We look forward to being part of an amazing family of like-minded people and fabulous podcasts.
And we are now in a position to offer our listeners bonus content via Headstuff Plus. By subscribing, you will help us do more with our podcast and grow. But more importantly, you will get access to our bonus material in the form of a spin-off podcast. And you'll get a heap of bonus content from every show on the network, regardless of which show you support.
Yes, Afif, but there is a twist. I can only handle so much time with you, so I have drafted in backup to help me.
Hello, listeners.
This is Anne, Afif's better half. I decided to join Afif to keep him in check and take the burden off poor Katie here. She's already deeply traumatized by the amount of time she's had to spend with him.
That is very true, Anne.
Yeah. So if you subscribe, you will be treated to a fabulous husband and wife. A fabulous wife discussion with a little bit of a husband involved.
I love this.
Yeah. And we'll expand on points raised in the Baby Tribe, and we'll throw in a little bit of science as well. The odd bit of abuse that I have to give Afif, well deserved. But Afif, what did you decide to call the bonus podcast?
So I've been waiting for over 10 years for this moment, so thank you for bringing it up. I've decided to call the podcast Keeping Up with the Kafashians.
Oh my God. That's it, Afif. That is the lamest thing I've heard in so long.
Look, I know there's another family that kind of sound the same, but I feel that they have copied the name from me rather than the other way around. But anyway.
Anne, any comments?
I had nothing to do with this. This is all him.
It's an amazing name. Please subscribe.
Join the Cast is back for its last stage. It's your turn to decide which will be your new favorite podcast. Whether you're into ghosts, fashion, GAA, anthropology, or the meaning behind names, just go to jointhecast.ie and vote for your favorite. The winner will get a podcast series worth 50,000 euro and will join Headstuff Podcasts. Vote now at jointhecast.ie.
So, what are we going to talk about today?
Okay, so today we're going to talk about, I know there's been loads of media coverage on chats about breastfeeding, exclusive breastfeeding, combination feeding, formula feeding. And I suppose we both agree that we feel quite uncomfortable about these terms at times, and putting parents into each individual box, because, and the benefits versus, are there benefits when you do combination, or when parents are only feeding a small amount of breast milk versus formula? And I suppose it kind of strengthens the debate between breast versus formula feeding. So we're going to talk about that kind of a little bit more in depth. And I think, guys, hold it back. I think Afif's got a bit of a nerdy segment coming up, and he's going to tell us a little bit about a study he may have read. So hit us, Afif.
Well, you see, people have asked for the nerdy segment to come back. And rather than labeling it as a nerdy segment, we're going to sort of slip it in under the radar every now and again with the episodes. The study that I want to talk about is a study that will help inform our conversation, because as you said, I don't like categorizing parents into different camps, because all that does is sow division rather than help us as healthcare providers provide unbiased supports regardless of your feeding choices. And we all know that some parents choose to use formula, some parents choose to combine for various reasons, and some parents, sometimes their breastfeeding journey does not work and they feel that they have to use formula. And sometimes they feel that they may do their children a disservice if they introduce formula.
Yeah, because I think like it is important to say that there are some parents, no matter how hard they try, and they might have had a vision, I suppose, in the early stages of breastfeeding or before they had their babies, that they wanted to exclusively breastfeed. But that option sometimes is removed.
She did air quotation marks.
I did, yeah, sorry. I suppose when we look at it, some parents don't have that choice. That choice is removed. And for the health of and well-being of the infant, they do in some situations need to use a supplementation of formula. And this can carry a huge amount of guilt and upset. And I suppose by labeling exclusive breastfeeding versus combination, all these other terms, I think it highlights and it can impact the well-being of that mother as well.
And I've heard this discourse, and I'm sure you've heard it too, sometimes alluding or suggesting that giving formula to your baby may cause harm.
Yeah.
And I really don't like using that word harm, because no parent ever wants to harm their child. And formula is not harmful. It meets the nutritional needs of a child over the first year of age.
And formula is a necessity. Let's just say it straight out there. For many infants, they would not be surviving if we did not have formula here. And we're not advocating for, like, it is a parental choice at times and it's not in other times. But we have the possibility of donor breast milk and everything else. But there are times where parents choose to formula feed, and that is their right and their choice. And we should be supporting and educating if they need that.
Yeah. And so what this study was discussing is, guess what? It does have the microbiome in it, which is what drew me to it. I know people are probably sick of hearing about the microbiome, but it is really something that I think is going to become more and more prominent in our medical chats. And the interesting thing is what the study has looked at is that not only did it look at the microbiome, it looked at something called the metabolome. And that's a new word that I don't think we have used on the Baby Tribe podcast so far.
And please explain, because I don't even know what that means.
And I didn't know what it was until I learned a little bit more about it. So what the metabolome is, it's the set of chemicals and molecules that the microbiome produces, almost sometimes as a byproduct of their normal processes, or some of them can actually be quite useful. So it's almost this sort of footprint of what is present in our gut. And guess how they measured it in the study? They looked at poo samples of kids.
Very interesting.
Very glamorous. Research can sometimes be so glamorous. So they examined the poo of all these kids that had either exclusive breastfeeding, sorry for using that term, a combination of formula and breastfeeding, and formula as well. And what they wanted to see, whether the introduction of formula to a child that's predominantly breastfeeding, does it actually negatively impact the microbiome and the chemicals produced by the microbiome? Because, again, there's this discourse to say that giving formula may actually negate all the benefits that breastfeeding may have on babies. And that is simply not true. And this study actually demonstrates that. What it demonstrates is that basically any amount of breastfeeding, no matter how small, will have a positive impact on the microbiome, will develop it in a way that is favorable. And the metabolome, so the metabolites that come out of this microbiome, are also favorable. Because I see a lot of parents coming to me in clinic are only able to give their child small amounts of breast milk, sometimes maybe only just one feed a day. And they come to me and say, is there a point? what is the point? And my answer to them always is, there is a point if this is something that you want to continue. Do not stop thinking that you're not helping your child or making a difference. Of course you are. Absolutely stop if you don't want to continue for other reasons. But do not stop thinking that what you're doing is futile. It is not. And what I really like about the study is that there's scientific evidence demonstrating that any amount of breast milk is beneficial for the child's microbiome and later health outcomes down the line.
I think that's really well said, because it's probably one of the biggest topics I get when I'm working with a mom and she potentially has a low milk supply. And they will ask, like, is there a point? And I would say the exact same thing as you have said. So this is quite an interesting paper. I think it's going to, I think the results and the content are going to be interesting to all parents.
And what I also want to emphasize, and it's very, very important for the sake of being inclusive, is, okay, well, a formula feeding parent that's predominantly formula feeding and not giving any breast milk is saying, well, what does that mean for my child? Is my child not getting any benefit whatsoever? And what I would say back to them, and the chat next week will probably help support what I'm about to say now, is that feeding is just one aspect of how the child develops down the line. There are so many other factors that determine the child's development that defining a child's outcome based on one factor, such as feeding, is never, never helpful. And the studies that demonstrate benefit of breastfeeding in comparison to formula do it on a global level. Okay, what does that mean? It means that if you looked at a large number of families that are predominantly breastfeeding versus a large number of families that are predominantly formula feeding, the studies suggest that certain aspects of outcome are better in the breastfeeding group compared to the formula feeding group. Well, a lot of the studies do not do, and they're beginning to do that now, is factor in other aspects of that impact development, the parents' socioeconomic status, smoking, income, their education, the use of screen time. We're going to chat about that next week. All of these things also have a big impact, and all of these things are potentially modifiable. So formula in itself does not harm your child. Formula provides all the nutritional needs that your child requires over the first 6 months, and then in addition to solids after the first 6 months. I want parents to rest assured that whatever choice they made or whatever feeding regimen that they ended up doing for their child is not something that's going to cause harm. And that's the message that I want to come out of today's chat.
And does the paper look that parents who do formula feed or combination feed, is there any way they can mitigate the effects? Had they looked into that in this paper or?
So they haven't looked at that, but they do suggest that because the microbiome plays a crucial part in health outcomes down the line, then it may give us insights into ways that parents can supplement the microbiome, maybe with the use of probiotics, for example. That's not something that is scientifically proven yet, but there is a suggestion that using probiotics in addition to formula feeding may help down the line. We don't know that for sure yet. We certainly know that things like antibiotic use, viral illnesses, can really disrupt the normal balance in your microbiome. And there is some evidence to suggest that an introduction of a probiotic during those times may actually help restore a normal, healthy microbiome sooner than if you didn't use it. And we know that from breast milk research. We know that babies that are breastfeeding are less likely to have a disrupted microbiome when they get antibiotics and when they get a viral infection or sick. So we use this research to help inform us in ways in how to support parents that don't breastfeed down the line.
And I suppose the positive thing from this study means that it kind of opens the doors for future studies. It kind of means that when we look at it, we need to look at, I suppose, development as a whole in a holistic picture with regards to feeding and all the other things that you spoke about with regards to social circumstances and living conditions, which we are going to talk about a little bit about next week.
Yeah, and every child's journey is unique, and it's about providing the best possible environment for them to thrive, whether that's through the diet, stimulation, or emotional support. There's so much more that we need to learn. We need to learn how those early metabolic changes, meaning how this kind of metabolic footprint can inform us and help us predict outcomes down the line. So this is still early days yet.
So, Afif, that was a really interesting paper. In fairness, to start off, kickstart our episode one of season 3. So what is coming up next?
So I want to do a bit of a segue. So when I first came to Ireland in 1995, I had a very Western or North American upbringing in terms of the movies and shows that we used to watch. So although when I was in Kuwait, I was educated in English, all the shows that we had were
American.
So I grew up with Saved by the Bell. Oh, do you remember that show?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Beverly Hills 90210. Yeah. So that's the culture I had in mind coming here. And that's not how Irish people behave. I honestly thought that I did my last year of Leaving Cert here, by the way, before getting into medicine. And I thought the school that I was in was going to be exactly like Saved by the Bell.
And that was a shock.
Oh, my God, that was such a culture shock. And I remember somebody pulling me aside to say, we need to beat that American culture out of you. So, I mean, not physically, metaphorically. And so they handed me a book called The Snapper. And they were like, read that.
Was that produced at that time?
Yeah, it was there, yeah.
Was the movie out?
I didn't watch the movie.
It's a great movie.
I've watched the movie since. And then I realized how I misread many of the words that were in the book. The second thing they asked me to do is watch The Commitments.
Oh, yeah.
And then the third thing they asked me to do is, do you know Eurovision? I said, what the hell is Eurovision? And they said, it's a European music competition, just like football, but for music. And there's semifinals and there's finals and there's points and there's a winner. I said, that sounds amazing.
And in the 90s, it was huge.
It was absolutely huge. And we all know about Niamh Kavanagh's triumph as a Eurovision winner in 1993. And myself and yourself met Niamh Kavanagh at the Irish Podcast Awards back in November. And I had a brief chat with her and I told her about the podcast that we're doing. And then she launched into a couple of amazing stories about parenthood. And I said, Niamh, I'm going to have to strip you away from Grow It Farley for just one day. And will you please come
and share them
with us? And she obliged. So I'm thrilled to welcome the remarkable talent to our podcast, Niamh Kavanagh. And that name, I'm sure, resonates with charm and musical prowess in Ireland and beyond. Niamh's not just a singer. She's an icon in the Eurovision, as you all know, and a celebrated figure in the Irish music scene. She was a key voice in the soundtrack of the critically acclaimed film The Commitments, where she performed both as lead and backing vocalists. Her journey into the limelight, though, began with her unforgettable victory in the 1993 Eurovision Song Contest, where she captured hearts across Europe with her powerful ballad, In Your Eyes. This song not only won the contest, but also became a beloved hit in Ireland. Do you remember the song, Katie?
I'm actually, when you said that, I was like, In Your Eyes, I'm actually singing it in my head.
Beyond Eurovision, she also worked in film. She has continued to enchant audiences both in Ireland and internationally with her music and live performances. She's been a mentor and an inspiration to so many inspiring artists as well, sharing her experience and insights gained from years in her industry. She co-hosts a podcast called Agony Rants with Grow It Farley, and I actually really like that. It's one of my favorite podcasts to listen to.
Afif actually has not stopped going on about this podcast since we started.
I know, I should stop plugging it because I don't want people to move over and listen to it. No, stay, listen here and then listen to it afterwards. But why is she here? She has also embraced an amazing journey of parenthood, raising two grown sons. Her experience as a parent spans a period marked by seismic changes in communication and the rise of social media. And this unique perspective, I think, offers invaluable insights into balancing a demanding career with family life in a rapidly evolving world. So we're not only excited to delve into her musical journey, but also to draw on her wisdom as a parent who has navigated these transformative times. Niamh, thank you so much for joining us on the Baby Tribe podcast. We met at the podcast awards.
We did.
And I remember, interestingly, I listened to your Agony Rants episode that came out the day before. And I remember Garode Farley, for anybody that's confused, by the way, I'm not Garode.
No, no.
Just in case. But I remember Garode saying that during the networking session, we are going to aim up. We're going to talk to podcasters that are higher up in the food chain. And he actually made a fatal error saying that, because what you guys didn't realize is that you're the guys at the top of the food chain and you had no way to look but down. And that's where I was sitting, looking up, saying, no, you're the guys that I'm going to go after.
But you know what's interesting about that, actually, that he says all that sort of stuff, but he doesn't really mean it.
I know, and that. And, yeah, no,
you know,
I know
he's
that.
Such a good boy.
Yeah.
But you know, I look at me all patronizing. But you know, the thing about it is, like, I do the podcast with Grode. I love podcasts. I listen to them all the time. But the thing is, the reality is, he understands it way better than I do. So I'm going,
I work the room. I don't care about the food chain.
Well, yeah, and I'm so glad our paths crossed, because yeah. I do listen to Agony Rant, and I find it so comforting on a Monday afternoon to listen to.
Yeah.
And I said, I must chat to Niamh, because I bet you she has amazing stories about being a parent, about being a mother, and I'd love to get her
many on
the Baby Tribe podcast. So you were in my target, and you were so obliging and lovely. So thank you so much.
It's absolutely my pleasure to be here.
And I suppose let's just get started, because you are our national treasure and everybody knows who you are. So let's just launch into, could you share with us the story of becoming a mother?
Okay, well, actually, I became a mother a little bit later. So, I mean, not by today's standards, but maybe when a few years back, it would have been kind of considered slightly later. So my first pregnancy, I was 32 when I first discovered I was pregnant, which is a bit of a shocker because I have polycystic ovaries. So I was always under the impression that I would have to do more. And clearly, Paul is definitely the magic ingredient. I don't know what it is. But anyway, we ended up getting pregnant and I was 32. And but I was up north. So that was kind of a new experience. Obviously, I was up the north. I was NHS based and I had to go and get tested and do all the things that I needed to do. So then it was quite a shift in my head to actually discover that I was pregnant. And I laughed quite a lot for a long time. I was not actually preparing.
So it wasn't something that was planned at
the
time?
No, I didn't plan either pregnancy necessarily. Don't get me wrong. I think, you know, to be very blatant, I think if you're having sex, you're planning to have a baby regardless of what birth control you're using, because there's nothing that's 100%.
Yeah.
But it's easy to say that in a sentence. You don't ever really think that you're going to be the one. Yeah. But we weren't necessarily planning, but we were not planning, if you understand. We're very joyful about it, so that was fine. But we discovered we were pregnant with my first boy, and I didn't, you know, the whole experience of it was new for me. But my mum had a baby when I was 15. So I kind of went through her kind of pregnancy with her in that vague way you do when you're a teenager, where you're not actually dialed into what's happening. And then my older sister had two children not long after my mum. So she was like five years after she had her first. And so she started young. But there hadn't been any children in between. So it was very big excitement. But for me as a person, all the changes that happened, and I was currently, you know, obviously gigging at the time, doing all sorts of different things and traveling. So there were some decisions to make very fast in regards to, you know, how I would approach, you know, would I be happy being on stage, being very pregnant, you know, all of those things. So I actually stopped gigging about 5 months in, went for my scans, which were very exciting. And I loved it. I had a very, very healthy pregnancy both times. So I was lucky. You know, I never was sick. The only time I didn't feel nauseous in the first early stages was when I was eating, and you know, which was very joyful for me.
Yeah.
But I never really got sick, which was really helpful. I didn't have that very sick period. You have the whole thing, the funny things that happen when you go into the midwife, and you know, your breast is sore, and all the things that happen to you as a woman that you can't believe is happening. And she said to me, the midwife at the time, she was old school, and she said, buy cabbage leaves. And I was saying, what's that for? And she says, the enzymes will help you cook, you know, calm down. I thought she was mad, but I was buying a head of cabbage before I knew it. Anyway, putting it in, you try anything. Anyway, but it's a funny thing, your experience and how you do it. I loved being pregnant both times. I have to say that. I loved being pregnant. Enjoyed the whole experience of it. And I suppose the in a nutshell, I didn't have many complications. They did offer me the test for the Down syndrome test, etc. My husband and I both decided that we wouldn't do it. It didn't matter to us. So they said it can sometimes help you prepare. And I do understand that. But my feeling was you can still prepare without actually being evasive. So you can actually prepare yourself for the Down syndrome situation, you know, by informing yourself, but you don't necessarily have to know the outcome. So we didn't find out the sex of our child and we didn't do any of that. We just made sure it was healthy on the way through, which we were very lucky.
Yeah. And it's amazing in a time, particularly now, mm-hmm. where there's very little unknown in terms of a pregnancy, that sometimes it's actually nice and liberating not to know. Mm-hmm. Obviously stay, you know, do whatever is reasonable in terms of looking after your health.
Oh, without a doubt. But
not knowing even the I think very few parents don't know the sex of their baby.
Yeah, it seems to be part of the whole thing now.
Yes, and all the gender reveals and all that.
You know, there's so much you can find out about your baby. Yeah. It's fascinating. You look at the lovely videos they produce now and all that sort of stuff. I still have the sonograms, obviously, of the boys.
Oh, wow, okay.
The ultrasounds. I still have my ultrasounds and stuff, which I love. You know, not the videos, the wee video, the wee pictures, they're in their boxes, you know, all of those things, along with the wee identity bracelet from when I was born. Because okay. my mum kept my one, you okay. know, the little
yes.
baby female and yes. all that. I went to the prenatal classes, which was the other thing, or the antenatal, sorry. I went to those because they were free, because up the north, the NHS provided them free. And weirdly, I changed all the decisions I thought I would make based on going to those classes. I didn't think I would, right? And, you know, my husband was older, very old school kind of in some ways. But he came to all of the classes and we had the conversations. But quite rightly, he said, these are decisions you need to make because it's your body or it's your decision.
And may I ask, what decisions did the prenatal or antenatal classes made you reconsider?
Well, actually, what happened to me was I always thought that I would have an epidural. That was, you know, I would say the second I'm having a contraction, you're going to be putting some sort of painkiller because there's no medals for martyrs in my head, right? And I still believe that in the sense of people, if you feel that you're not capable of doing something, there's no reason why you can't be using an epidural. It's not that. But I learned about the fact that you could use gas and air and all of these things. And they explained that I could have a bath at the end of it if I didn't have an epidural. When you have an epidural, you have to be immobile for a while and stuff like that. They also said that I could choose to have an epidural during the process, instead of making the decision before I went in. And, you know, we all know there's a point where you no longer are viable for an epidural. You know, that comes. But, you know, I kind of thought I'll do it for as long as I feel comfortable. But my whole aim was to get into that bath at the end of it. But I actually learned an awful lot about the people who would be working with me, because obviously we did it in the hospital that we were going to, which is the Royal in Belfast. You then learn to trust in the people that are involved in it, and they're giving you information all the time about what may or may not happen. And they do give you worst case scenarios, but they also reassure you about the stuff that is, I suppose, mundane, but it's not mundane to you because you're going through it for the first time. So I guess also my personality is inclined to go, well, these people know what they're doing, so I'm going to give them that job. So that was one of the big decisions I made. The other decision I made, which I wasn't expecting, was to breastfeed. Not that I was anti it, but I had no real experience of it because my mother wouldn't have breastfed or anything like that. So she, you know, I remember making that decision and my mother going, well, you know, how are you going to live your life, especially you with all the things you do? And it was one of the best decisions I ever made, because I'm not a very good girl for routine sometimes, although I like routines in my life because I'm quite, you know, I like things all measured up. But what I really liked about the breastfeeding aspect was, luckily I was able to, because obviously you have to just, you don't really know that till you're there. The other thing is that it helps you in your healing, which they explained to you that it will help you heal afterwards because that's the natural body's way of working. But the other side of that I found was that I didn't have to prepare bottles. I didn't have to worry about anything. I just had to feed my yeah. baby. And I found that very liberating. And, you know, it was a brilliant, brilliant thing for me.
It's actually amazing that you've said that. And the reason I'm saying this is because only last week there was an article in the Irish mm-hmm. Times that have said the absolute opposite.
Yes.
That the pressure on women to breastfeed means that they lose their liberty, that they add another additional burden on their sort of postnatal course with their baby, and that the societal expectations of mothers to feed adds an additional stress and pressure for them to do so. Mm. Now, that's not taken away from the fact that mums who choose not to breastfeed or cannot breastfeed shouldn't be supported.
No.
They obviously absolutely should be, and we do that on the podcast here. But hearing your account will be actually very refreshing for a lot of mums who may be considering breastfeeding and are worried about that sentiment that came out of that article, because it was mentioned widely on yeah. social media. I don't know if you came across it.
No, I didn't. Well, funny enough, I'm not on the feed that nowadays, because I'm yes. a menopausal woman. They don't give me a lot of that sort of thing. But do you know what's really funny, actually, you saying that, right? Because I remember when I made that decision and I started feeding, my mum, I think she was trying to encourage me to have more help, really. And the other thing that you have to remember also, the people around you want to be involved with your baby. And I think because you're feeding, they sometimes think they can't be doing the thing they want to do, which is to feed the child. You know, they want to be integral to helping you. But in a very short space of time, if you want to, you can express, you can do whatever. Plus, as I did on my second, because he was a much hungrier baby than my first boy, you know, because they're very different. Every child is very different when they come out. You know, you can actually integrate it with Formino. You can, you know, you don't have to be one thing or the other. Once the first 6 weeks are over, you know, and I learned all this during the classes. So it suited my lifestyle. I'll give you a very good example. When I was coming to Dublin, because I would have still had to do a lot of traveling and stuff like that. So I had Jack with me as my first boy, and we were coming down to visit my mum very early on, maybe about, he was maybe 3 to 4 months old. And we got caught on the M50 in a very bad traffic jam. And we were there for an hour and a half, but I'd already driven down from Belfast. So he was already past his time. And I didn't have to worry about whether I had a bottle. I didn't have to worry about anything. I literally fed him. I moved over onto the side. I fed him. And then he was happy. And at night times, the deal was if I fed at night, then Paul would change the nappy or do the other thing. So we had a reciprocal. It wasn't like I had to do everything.
Yes.
And yes, it is tying in the sense that you are the one that has to do it. But it depends on your attitude to it, in the sense of, you know, luckily Jack, and still to this day, that's my eldest boy, he only eats as much as he wants. So he wasn't a very hungry baby, shall we say. So it was easy to feed him. Tom, very different boy, 25 over the percentile. So he was as big as you over the percentile as Jack was below it. And so therefore he had much bigger appetite and wanted that sort of thing. So his feeding was different. He couldn't feed him enough. Then you see when it kind of latches into when it becomes comfort. And so it's about recognizing that. So I made it work in my life, and I did it for as long as I needed to, but actually managed to do it for maybe 6 months with Tom and 9 months with Jack. As soon as I started weaning them into real food, it became less of an issue. I moved away from it. It was a lovely thing to be able to do. And it suited me because I didn't have to use sterilizers. I didn't have to use any of those things. Didn't have to plan when bottles need made. I was never caught in any situation. So it suited my life. If it doesn't suit your life and you feel the pressure of it, then you shouldn't have to do it. Because after the first few weeks, it's really just about,
all about what works for you, really, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, but in a million years, if you'd asked me, I would never have seen that being me.
Yeah.
And yet that's where I ended up. And most of it was made through decisions of what would suit my life.
And you were breastfeeding at a time where breastfeeding rates were almost non-existent.
Yeah, it wasn't as prevalent. And my mom used to say, you know, and my mom is amazingly supportive. I don't mean that. And she's a great mother. But, you know, she saw it as getting in the way of me living my life. But she thought the same when I got a pup during it. You know, she kind of saw it as an extra thing in your life. And that, you know, but only you can do that. So who's going to mind your child? But people could still mind my child. I would maybe express or do whatever. And I just was lucky enough because of my career to be able to section times and do that. And I had a very supportive husband who was quite happy for that. And he did pick up the slack in other places. So it's just, the only thing I would say is that I think there's an awful lot of pressure on mothers to do everything, to be everything, to be successful in your career, be this, that and the other. And, you know, and run a household and do this. But I also think that pressure is on men also in a different way. And you don't have to be doing everything. You should just stop thinking about what other people expect. You know, you've created a life. You've probably wanted it, you know, for a long time. You should be enjoying that, and you should make it work within your own environment.
Yeah.
You know, you should not be taking what other people. Absolutely listen to advice. It can be very helpful. Sometimes you can get things that will work for you, and then maybe things that you go, oh, maybe that's where I'm going wrong. You know, you can see from other people's experience, so you can learn from that. But at the same time, what you should do as a person is do what works for you. You know, that's the most important thing. And actually, generally, you're not wrong, because you're doing it from love.
On that, I wanted to ask you, how did you then manage to balance being a mum, being a busy parent, raising two kids, while also having an amazing, illustrious music career?
Well, I did what everybody does. I made choices. I made choices to be home. I put infrastructures in, you know, as the children grew, I put in places where they could be looked after. I had faith in people to do what they needed to do. I created the environment so that I made choices to be able to still go. So, for instance, I changed for the period of time when they were much younger. I changed the way I worked, so I didn't work so much away, which meant that I could put them to bed and maybe go do my gig and then come back. Now, it probably meant that I had very little sleep in between the time they came back. you know, and then they were up. It's only for a period of time. So you do what you do. And the thing is, I also was lucky because I could block my work and then have be the person who collected them and brought them to school. I know I was lucky, right? I know I'm lucky. I'm also lucky because the choices I made, I still allowed myself to be myself in that time. And I think often what happens when you have children, you lose who you are because you're so focused on minding them, especially when they're very small. But the choices I made, especially as they got a little bit older, is to actually go, now it's about me now. And they should see me do what I do and make what makes me happy as a person. Because when they come to be parents, they have permission then to be humans in their own space. They don't have to give. I think there's this concept now, and probably always, but in particular now, that you have to give everything to the children and that you don't have a right to have a life. And I don't agree with that at all. I think they have to see that you have a right as a person to exist in the world, because it's a very short period of time that you have that happen and they're going to be off in their own lives. So you're giving them permission to go off and do their own life. And that's the most important thing. So, you know, I feel very strongly about that. But I made choices. And then also there's a little bit of luck involved in it, because A, I had a great partner who always encouraged me to do so. And then also I had a great support structure. I made friends, because obviously I wasn't in where I grew up. So I made friends with other people in schools and things. I created my own support network. And then on top of that, then you go on and you make decisions as because every stage brings you to a different thing. So you have to make those decisions.
You've very eloquently described how you took charge of your life and you made it what it is. Yet it's interesting that you said a couple of things that I wanted to pick up on. Mm-hmm. You said, I had a good pregnancy. I was lucky. I had a good life. I was lucky. Isn't it interesting how a lot of women would call themselves lucky if things go their way? The expectation is that things don't go your way. And I suppose I wanted it to be a message to people that the majority of the time things go well.
Yes,
so
they do.
Labeling, you know, I had a good pregnancy, I was lucky, may sometimes give the impression that most pregnancies don't go well.
It's funny you should say that. You're right. You're absolutely right about that. And actually, I made choices all the way through and I took the information on. And as I said, the classes were very instrumental in that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other thing that I have found all my life is that I decide how I'm going to feel about a thing. And so before I go in for operations, before I went in, I decided that this is going to go well. So until it's not going well, I'm not going to assume that's what's going to happen. Yeah. And I can relax into those situations. And my friends, my husband often says it, you know, he's always quite surprised by my attitude to it. But I think actually largely things do go well.
Yeah.
And I think most of it comes also from your choice to accept that you're not going to fight the situation. This is where you are. So you have choices all the time to make your life good. You're right. I am lucky in the sense, I say I am lucky because sometimes it's not through your own fault that things don't go the way they should. We know that, right?
Yes.
So in other words, you can be in a situation, do all the right things, be in the right frame of mind, and still the situation will require intervention. During childbirth, we know that, and that doesn't make it your fault. And I think that would be important to say as well, you know, because actually sometimes that's just what happens.
Yeah.
But as a person, I was lucky in the sense that I have quite a strong constitution. I made good choices. I was able to trust gas and air because, as I said to you before, as a singer, I really trusted my breathing. So I actually felt very comfortable with what it was given to me, because I think a lot of the times when people say gas and air doesn't work for them, it's because they're not breathing correctly and they're not actually receiving what they need from the actual sedative, I suppose, whatever, the way it kind of calms you during it. And actually, you know, it's down to how you are in that environment. I absolutely trusted my midwives coming in and out the staff. So I was very relaxed through the whole process. Which sounds weird to say, because it's not a normal thing that's happening to you. I seem to recall in my first pregnancy, which was long, or my first labour, I went in, Jack came on his due date. Let me just give you a quick brief overview. He came on his due date, which I wasn't expecting, because my mum's experience was always 2 weeks over in all of us. And my sister was the same. So I was not expecting him to come. 2 o'clock in the morning, I got up, as you do, to go to the toilet, and then suddenly realised that this is probably my waters breaking. And within half an hour, I was having contractions between 3 and 4 minutes apart. So I was straight into full labour, no messing about. Arrived in, got my thing, they checked me out. I was about 4 centimetres. They said, well done. I think it's the only time I ever threw up because I was like, oh my God, that's such a shock. I wasn't expecting it because, you know, on your first, you think it's going to be really long. And then what happened was I was in full labour, but didn't thin, you know, you dilate, but you don't thin. And therefore, I didn't deliver till 10 to 5 the next day. I was exhausted by the end of it. But during that period, I had 2 different midwives. One of them was from Monaghan, and I was trying to tell her a joke the whole way through, which I thought was hilarious. It was literally a 2-line joke, which is basically, what do Monaghan and a pregnant cow have in common? They're both close to Cavan, right? But I would say, considering what I was going through, that probably took me about 1.5 hours to tell her that, right? I thought it was hilarious. I'm not sure she found it so funny. But what I'm saying, and, you know, the whole way through my first pregnancy, I was apologising for the fact I hadn't taken the hair off my legs because, you know, I didn't expect him to come. I'd eaten smoky bacon crisps. I was apologising for that. It's ridiculous what you do. But you're in an environment that's not normal, right? But you're among people who care about what they do. And so you have to have that trust in it. And so my experience of it is what it is, right? And the second one, Fast and Furious, came 4 hours labour, that's it. But he was over. So every experience is different from that point of view.
So looking back on all of this, what has been the most rewarding thing for you?
The most rewarding thing is what it has brought to my life. I have achieved many brilliant things in my life and I've done extraordinary things. The list is endless because I'm curious. And the minute somebody says to me, do you want to do this? Like, I laugh because during Eurovision, they asked me, did I want to drive a digger? I said, absolutely. You know, I'd be like that. I mean, how often would you get that opportunity? You don't, right? So I take the opportunities when they come. And, you know, I've done Celebrity MasterChef. I've been in Eurovision
Congrats
twice.
On winning that, by the way.
I did. Thank yes. you. No one more surprised than me, right? But, you know, I've done lots and lots of things. And I think some of my favourite things that I've achieved are more less salubrious, shall we say, less known in the thing. But there are moments in my life when I look at it and I still say one of the best things that I ever did was my involvement, however small it is, in the fact that I have created these 2 human beings who are magnificent in every way. And they'd be mortified if they heard me saying this, but, you know, and they'd be saying, you never say that to us, but I do. Every day I try to tell them in how I feel and the faith that I give them to be human beings.
It's such an under-recognized achievement, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is because so many people achieve it, but don't actually recognize how important it is.
Yeah.
You know, I was raised by 2 great people and I have 3 lovely siblings for various reasons. We have a lovely family and we're very bonded, very supported. And no matter what happens in this world, these people are linked to me. Even though we're different people and we do different things, we have different friends, we are linked by that. My children, I look at them every day. I still remember when Jack and Tom were born that I couldn't stop looking at their little hands, their feet. I couldn't believe that I did that. I mean, I don't know what I did, but I did it, you know, and I'm part of that and they're part of me. And 5 years ago when my husband had a stroke, even though I was given out to them every day for not cleaning the rooms, they managed to get their father in an ambulance and saved him. You know, so beautifully. So I could never give out to them again for their rooms after that. You know, these people who are magnificent in the world, they're not out changing the world, but they could if they want. But it doesn't matter. These people are human beings who are contributing to the world. They have a sense of humor. They have a sense of responsibility. They are funny. They have, you know, they're busy in their lives. They're not ringing me every day or anything. That's not the way we roll. But they are humans in the world who can contribute to it. And that is the greatest achievement that I've ever done.
I mean, the reason humanity has survived is because of what you have just said.
Yeah.
You know, and if it wasn't for women and motherhood, we wouldn't exist. So I think it's something that needs to be celebrated. And you're right. It is one of the most important things that anyone can do.
Yeah, no, I think so. But I also know that not everybody has to do it. I never actively thought I'm going to have children or I can't wait to have children. I was too busy in my life. I didn't really feel that way. What I did was when I found out I was having the children, first of all, when I got over the fact that I was going to have to be a grown up doing it, you know, it was quite a thing to discover it. But actually, I've really enjoyed every phase of motherhood.
Yeah.
Every single one.
And speaking of phases of motherhood, have you noticed a change in how people parent?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have. But the more things change, the more things stay the same, right? And this conversation comes up all the time. People say, oh, it's so different now. And I want to say, maybe it's different. You know, maybe things are different, but actually, essentially, the job is still the same. So, for instance, tonight I could be singing for 7 people and tomorrow night I could be singing for 350 million people, which I've done both. But the job is still the same, right? And motherhood is exactly the same. Your job is to create an environment and a resilience in the people you're raising, and an understanding that the world is not always going to be what they want, but that nothing is ever the end, that nothing is... It's always about the start of a new thing. So your job is to love and nurture these people in whatever way that is. And yes, there are new challenges. We can talk about the social media situation. We can talk about all of those things. They are essentially important things and they have changed the dynamic. However, I will say this about social media, right? The thing is, you say, oh, social media destroys people. But actually, if you look back to when I was young, your social media world was where you lived, right? And where you went to school and when you went to thing. And if something happened that was not good in that situation, you felt scarred by it and you felt like everybody knew it. So that's the same experience on social media. The thing about it is that was your world. So social media is the world now, but neither of them reflect what the world really is. They just are the spaces that you live in. So your job is still to teach them how to exist in a world and still retain who they are as people, and to understand that that doesn't define everything. So we can't stop technology progressing. You know, it's progressed an awful lot in the 56 years I've lived on this planet. When I was growing up, TV was, you know, something that came on at tea time. And if you were lucky, there was a small bit of children's TV at lunchtime. And now you can access anything, anytime, yeah, anywhere.
And just on that, I remember telling my son recently mm-hmm. that we only grew up with 2 TV channels and they both closed down at 10 p.m. And he couldn't fathom, what do you mean closed down? As in, and I said to him, as in, there was nothing. I was like, no, but there must be something on TV. I was like, no, Faisal.
No.
There was nothing. There was this static. He's like, what's static? And I had to show him what static looked like. I was like, this is what was on TV from 10 p.m. until 8 a.m. the next day.
That's it.
Those grey and black dots. Yes, yes, Faisal, yes.
And did you explain to him that the majority of television wasn't for children?
Because, yeah. You and know, I told him that there was only like maybe half an hour of cartoons. And he also asked me this question, just to show you how a lot of children these age, my son is now 13, can't fathom a life without smart screens. So he asked me, Dad, when did the iPad change from being black and white to colour? And I'm going,
like, I know. It's funny because actually I grew up obviously at a time when the only phone in the house was the one in the hall. And, you know, that was it. You weren't in touch with your friends the way that you are now. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Right. Yeah. I really don't. I think people fear the social media because they don't really understand it, or, you know, how people communicate. They say, oh, he's always on his phone, but he's communicating. You know, and I know that my children know how to speak.
Yeah.
They don't always speak to me, but I know they do. The change has happened and how we grew up. But actually, my parents, go back another generation, I think when they were small, there wasn't TV, or maybe it was only at the stages where not everybody had it. So go back further. So it has progressed a huge amount by the looks of things in the last while. But I still think the skills to survive it are the same. Yeah. What we do as a job, we have to give them the resilience to understand that the world is what it is. And I don't think that changes massively.
And that's a key point. And, you know, it took me a while to actually learn that myself personally, in that I was always, let's protect them from A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And fair play to my wife, who said, no,
we need to
teach them how to manage A, B, C, D, E. And, you know,
without a doubt, your job is not to stop them from failing. And I struggled to use that word.
Yeah.
Failure is not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is the resilience to understand that actually nothing is ever the end.
Yeah, because for example, my daughter used to come to me and say, can I take the bus to Dunleer with my friends? And I said, absolutely not. I'm going to drop you and pick you up. And Anne would be like, Afif, how is she going to learn how to take a bus?
Yeah.
If you don't let her take a bus.
But you also have to have faith in her that she will bring you.
Yes.
You know, and I have faith in my sons. They're not in touch with me all the time, right? And I think the best way I can describe this is when somebody asks me, when they're starting with the children, they always say, you know, what's your best thing? I say, your job actually is, from the minute you have them, is to let them go. And that's really hard because, you know, you're so on them when they're very small. But you're right. They need to have that independence and understand how to be in that space.
Yeah.
I think, fair play to your wife, we obviously would be good friends.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking more and more. She'd be gutted she missed you today, because, you know, it actually, they need to learn.
They
life.
Do.
They really need to learn life.
And, you know, actually, they're very well-rounded when they do. And I mean, yes, there are lots of things we want to encourage them. And yes, we want to protect them. I would have spent my summers up in Donegal when they were young, and the boys would tell you, like, they feel so deprived, because I used to literally bring them up for 2 months. I'd block my work so I could bring them up, and they lived like feral cats, basically. So we had a van on the side of this beach, and so the only rule was that you couldn't be on the beach without an adult, you know, but we would have gone to the water every day. But they had to learn how to live in groups of different children. You know, they had to learn how to survive like the Lord of the Flies, shall we say. But, you know, I wasn't always involved in those decisions. It was an environment where they'd be safe. I know sometimes in the city it's really hard to let them go beyond where they need to be, because I grew up in the city. So I would go to Kilcullen during my summers when I was young, and we'd get on a bike and cycle to Wicklow, for God's sake. And, you know, you wouldn't even fathom doing that when you were
The stories my wife used to tell me about when she was a child in Ballina in Mayo.
Oh, yeah.
And they used to be allowed, the six of them, to cycle together all the way to Enniscrone Beach.
That's right.
And as long as they were back by 6 p.m., of course, there was no phones. You couldn't track them.
No.
You didn't know what the hell they were doing.
Can you imagine living that
kind of world? I actually can't.
But that's what you had to do. But yeah. I technically raised my children the same way. And one year in primary school, I got 5 Mother's Day cards. None of them were from my children, because they were from the boys who wanted to go there. And they went there on summers. And I used to bring their friends up. At a certain age, they needed other friends up, you know, because there's nothing happening here, basically. And they loved it, because they grew up in an area that they had to discover how to examine. And also the other thing that was really lovely was, say they spent the year in primary school, and they didn't have massive problems in primary school, but, you know, maybe they had issues and stuff. But they realised that wasn't all the world. And I think actually we hold on tight in thinking that we're protecting them. But then all we're doing is that they're going to hit it at some point. They're going to hit the characters who are difficult. They're going to hit the situations that are difficult. And the more you hold them tight away from that, the problem is the second it happens to them, it could happen at a pivotal moment when they're in their mid-teens or their late teens, and they're not prepared to deal with it because they haven't lived in that world. They don't experience it. Whereas they're young and then they survive it, and you say, well, look, you know, this is...
Yeah.
You're going to have to learn how to speak to these people. I raised my children with quite a high level of sarcasm, to be honest with you, because that's how I roll. But the thing is, they actually are not in any way overawed. Nobody overawes them. They don't feel intimidated by people. I'm not saying that there aren't people who try to be difficult with them, but they know that that's not personal, and they won't accept it from them, which I admire greatly about them, you know, because I definitely wasn't like that as a child.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just saying I want to equip them with skills to live in the world. We're not always going to be there. So imagine if you protect someone completely in space, and then you release them into the wild at 18, and suddenly that stuff is going to happen. They are in no way prepared for it.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, you've kind of left them more vulnerable instead of better, you know.
Can I ask you, what was the most challenging aspect?
Oh, so many things. So many things. First major aspect, I grew up in a house full of girls. I have 3 sisters. No, my dad was there, but he was, you know, we made him a room to go watch sport in. Do you understand me? Like, we loved our dad, but he was always very respectful of us as women. The women ruled the house. I only got boys. That I was not prepared for the boy dynamic. Very different conversation, even though I get on very well in that environment because I'm very straightforward as a person. And I work mostly with men in the music industry, weirdly, you know, especially in the early stages. So it wasn't, and most of my friends actually in my teens were boys, because there was no girls my age around my area. So which made a very difficult teen years, I'm going to tell you that. So I found that challenging. In every period, there's a different challenge. So the initial challenge when they're very small is the physical challenge. Obviously, the timing, the relentless changing, you know, making sure they're OK, all the physicals. And then you're watching for the developmental things and all of those things that you feel that people are telling you have to have. So as you get older, it becomes less physical and much more emotional and, you know, cerebral, you might say. So you then have to get into the negotiation period, as I would call it. So you've your full-time kind of care when they're very small. Then you have the golden years, as I call it, when they're kind of independent enough that they can do enough for themselves, but also think that you have value in the world because that's their job, you know, because you're still the center of their universe. And therefore, you know, usually till about 12 or 13, actually, then that starts to shift into, quite rightly, they're looking outside for their influences and they're trying to establish themselves as human beings. And so then that bit is probably challenging in a different way because you're dealing with the worry of them going down the rabbit hole, as I would call it. That was challenging for me, where I was always afraid they would stop talking to me. And that worried me.
Yeah.
And it was challenging because we went from an area where you're in control of everything they do, and then you have to let them be in control. That's challenging. But I enjoyed the challenges of each. I enjoyed the challenge that they brought to me and, you know, made me find new things in myself. The biggest challenge, actually, I think overall, is to manage your own expectations, because you look at these two wonderful human beings who should be ruling the world, and you know they have the capability of it, and they want to work in the local shop down the road, and you're going, what the hell is wrong with you? You know, why are you not doing this? You're amazing. But actually, they're amazing no matter what they do. So you have to manage your expectations. I don't know if you've come across it yet, but you know, when parents get together, the first question you say is, what's he doing now? And we do that. We even do it to the children. We say, what are you going to do next? We don't actually ever say what you're doing is good enough. And I think that's the biggest lesson I've learned in the last few years, to actually say to my boys, I'm proud of what you're doing, because you know how to learn how to pay your bills. You know how to do this. You know how to live your life. And, you know, when you're ready, you'll do whatever you need to do. And whatever you decide to do is enough. I think, you know, you want more for them because you want financial stability. You want them to show how amazing they are. But actually, your expectation doesn't have to be theirs.
Yeah.
That, to me, is the biggest challenge, because you go, you are the most amazing person on the planet, because clearly you've made them. So obviously that's true.
Obviously.
True. You know, and that's true of every child, right? They have potential. You see the potential of them and you think, for God's sake, why are you not doing that? Your life would be so much easier. But then if you really took off the rose-coloured glasses and looked at what you were like at that age, chances are you probably weren't too far off it, you know. So you've got to allow them to find that themselves, because there's no better achievement than when your child suddenly discovers that they have the ability to do whatever it is they want.
Yeah.
There is no bigger achievement as a parent, because you have given them that, even though you think they're coming against you. But imagine that they can actually stand to you and say, this is what I want. And so you know that no matter what happens to you, they will survive it. You know, that's the biggest fear as a parent, I think, isn't it? That you know, what will happen to this child if I'm not there for them?
I feel like I'm sitting in a therapy session. No, and I don't say that.
Is that a bad thing?
No, absolutely, absolutely not. I think you missed the calling in being a life coach. I mean, you've given us so much wisdom. Because up until now, we have focused on the early years in this podcast, and you've given us an amazing perspective of what it is like to be a parent when your children grow, and actually watch them throughout, throughout their growth.
Yeah.
I could chat to you absolutely forever, but I know your time is precious. I want to ask you one final question. Okay. What advice would you offer new parents today?
Wow, so many things. But I have a wonderful story to illustrate the most important one, right? When my son was about 14 or 15, my eldest boy, he was going for some dental appointment, and we went. I take him out of school to bring him to this dental appointment. And what I do is I tend to find those moments and I try and extract information to see how happy they are in their lives, and looking for validation as a parent, I think, really. But so I brought him out for something to eat afterwards, and a friend of mine was, her sister was going through therapy, and she asked me a very interesting question, which was, what do you remember of your experiences with your mother, right? And we were both talking about that on our walk, and I thought, I'm going to ask my son this question, which I would advise people not to do, because it's devastating when you get the answer, right? So here's the thing. I asked him, what do you remember as me as a mother? And I waited for the multitudes of wonderful things that I've done. And he thought about it for a while. First, after his eyes rolled back in his head, because they hate it. But I bought him a hot chocolate and a lunch, so he felt he should. And his answer was, you wouldn't let us have Grand Theft Auto because we weren't old enough. That's it. That's all he had to say. And I went, is that it? And he said, yeah, pretty much. I said, and you know, all the times I brought you to, you know, all these things that we've done together, all these wonderful experiences, all the great things you have in your life, none of that registers. No, that's pretty much it. Now, there's two things I'm going to say. He didn't appreciate the other stuff because it wasn't important. That's just what life was. And actually, that's your goal, right? That's your goal. You don't have to be told how brilliant that is. When that person in front of you says that's the only hardest thing that's happened in his life, that's okay, right? And in a weird way, that's good, because the response to that is you shouldn't have had it anyway, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because he was 14, right? You shouldn't have been Grand Theft Auto. So that's okay. I'm doing my job. That's my job. But he was so secure in the love of what he had, he didn't actually need to register anything else. So I say to young people when they have, or, you know, new parents, don't sweat the small stuff. Do the small stuff. The small stuff is important. Read the books, do the things, you know, with your children. Do the stuff with your children. But if you don't happen to do it on a day, don't sweat it. They won't, the overall love that you have will be there with them. So don't sweat if you don't do the feed exactly at the right time. Don't sweat if you're not doing it exactly the same as the other person. Don't gauge your child's development based on what people say in a book or what the people say around. Everybody reaches their own space in their own thing. Don't sweat that stuff. Do it, care about it, but don't sweat it. Understand that the love you have and the boundaries you give your child will be enough. And don't give them Grand Theft Auto until they're old enough. You know, do you understand me? Don't sweat. You are the parent. Don't forget that. And I think there's an awful lot of pressure on people to do all the right things and all the right moments. You know, my youngest boy, or my eldest boy, he didn't talk for about 2.5 years. Very basic communication. Very clever boy. Brought him to all the audiologists, because you do. And he was very selective in his hearing. I think that's the way they said it, basically.
Yes.
He didn't need to say anything because I supplied everything for him. So he waited till he could speak in sentences. He wasn't interested in saying the words.
Yeah.
And he's just as eloquent as anybody else. So I could have sweated about that, but I didn't need to. I'm not saying don't check it out or don't do what's good for your child, but do not overstress.
Yes.
Enjoy the experience. Put good guidelines in, because still be the parent. I'm very much an advocate of that. I think your child will have enough friends. Be friendly with your child, but be the parent. That's really important. And I know it's hard sometimes because you want to give them everything and do all the right things. But the reality is you must give them the sense of, you are safe because I'm in control. You know, that's a really big thing. I do it when I go on stage. Yeah. When I walk out on stage, I'm telling you from the second I walk out on stage, I'm the boss of you and we'll be fine.
Amazing.
You know, and I think in a weird way, that's the way parenting is. You've got to make, they're going to push against it because that's their job. That's part of their growing. You'll decide what's important. Don't let other people tell you what's important, what's not.
Yeah.
You decide what's important. You decide, this is what I want. I need sleep. So therefore, a good sleep system works well. If that's not important to you, if you want to stay up all night doing all the things, fine. You know, that's, so what? You know, eventually they'll figure it out. There are great gifts you can give your children by showing you. But more importantly, be the parent, decide what's important, make it work, and don't sweat it.
Amazing. It'll be great. Well, Niamh, you have totally bossed this interview.
Sorry.
Absolutely. And this is not a bad thing at all. Thank you so much for coming on the Baby Tribe podcast. We really, really appreciate it. And we really appreciate the time.
Oh, no, it's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. We're delighted to have shared this time with you, offering guidance and support for your parenting journey.
I've been Afif and she's been Katie, and together we've been your guide in exploring the multifaceted world of parenting. Remember, every step you take in nurturing your child makes a world of difference.
Stay connected with us and don't miss our next episode, where we'll continue to delve into the valuable insights and practical tips for raising healthy and happy children. Thank you for being part of our tribe, and remember, you're doing an amazing job.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member
at headstuffpodcasts.com.